Have you ever had a feeling that something dreadful was about to happen?
This whole premise is sweaty.
Okay, moving right along.
You gonna plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter?
Just remember that this thing isn't as black as it appears.
Hold on to your butt.
The only difference between me and a homeless man is his job.
I'm glad you're here to tell us.
I'm looking for the least possible amount of responsibility.
And that ain't bad.
I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Man's got to know his limitations.
I'm glad you came back.
In the bag.
Network. I drink it up.
Welcome to the Bag Pod, everyone. We've got yet another, the other Los Angeles correspondent, if you will, for In the Bag, which is Will Templin. Will, what's going on?
Oh, not too much. Happy to talk to you. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I don't think we've talked since I was in L.A., right, for the most part.
You came out to L.A.
2 years. You know,
two years ago? Wow.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And you're still in Texas, right?
I am still in Texas.
You know, everything's bigger in Texas, and
I suppose.
I mean, how is Texas?
It's hot.
Oh.
Yeah. Other than that, I don't know. I mean, clearly Austin's a cool place. It would be nice if I had some sort of job, but this is not
that always
the,
helps. Yeah.
This is not the Chris Bajano bitching for an hour about not having a job podcast.
Oh, okay. Okay. I mean, we could talk about that if you want.
But maybe we'll save it for the end for everyone that's just, now that we've teased it, they'll have something to look forward to at the end.
Yeah, you always have to whet their appetite.
Exactly.
Yes, go ahead.
In any case, we originally wanted to have Will on for the podcast that I just did with Jake earlier in the week for the Oscar sort of review podcast. But due to conflicting schedules, we were not able to have that. So hopefully this podcast will not be too much of a rehash of the podcast from earlier in the week.
And it shouldn't be.
Exactly. And considering that Will just released his top movies of 2011, who better to talk to today than Mr. Templin?
Yes, unlike the Academy Awards, I didn't have a list of nine. I limited it to five. I usually pick out five every year. Mm-hmm. For the last 10 years or so, and I do that because A, it limits you and makes it easier to examine those films, but also it's always hard coming up with 10 or even 9 films. Usually there's not a lot to choose from. Most of the stuff that's all overhyped is what it is. It's overhyped and it's not worth my time.
Exactly.
And most of the pictures that are, you know, box office draws, the big box office draws are, you know, as shown lately, they're sequels, they're big CGI affairs that most of the time don't hold up to any recognition at all.
Exactly.
They're popcorn movies that you know, they are what they are and they make tons of money. And
I mean, let's be honest, there are a few that can be quite good blockbuster-esque kind of movies that can be very good considering what they are. You know, blockbuster movies, but
like what?
Well, I mean, you know, you would say, I mean, I would say like maybe the Batman movies are a little higher quality than your normal Transformers.
I'm gonna no comment on that one. I remember when we saw the Dark Knight together.
Yeah, we did. We don't need to rehash that. But I mean, I'm just saying there can be some movies that are better quality than your usual blockbusters.
I mean, honestly, Chris, I think if something like Inception was the normal fare for popcorn movies, I would be fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think it goes back to what I think of generally about the film industry right now and what people are accepting as good movies. I think we've lowered the standard so much, the bar so much, where Inception is considered a great film nowadays.
Yeah.
Or something above average when, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that would have been an average film. There's nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all spectacle. And people say, oh, well, it made me think. Well, it's, you know, obviously you're not thinking that much of the time
You didn't really need to. I mean, everything was laid out for you there. There wasn't
exactly. I mean, it's an interesting idea, a dream within a dream within a dream. But how often has it been written about in films? You know, film is the filmmaking and the filmmaking process, and what you see on screen is a reflection of dreams and people's fantasies. And so, I mean, that's an interesting thing to talk about, but it's not very deep. And a lot of these movies I notice nowadays are very superficial.
Mm-hmm.
Even these so-called deep films are—they're not smart. They're not interesting.
Yeah.
And that's why I say, like, Inception is a good popcorn film. There's nothing to it, and I wish, you know, all standard popcorn films were kind of like that. That would be like The Bar.
The
standard Bar, and then, you know, anything above that would be great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's all that I was saying. There's clearly quality with. I mean. There's clearly varying qualities within popcorn/blockbuster movies. They're not all just like, ugh, you know, they're all crappy, they're all just stupid. There are some that are at least entertaining for the most part. Before we get into what's actually on your best movies of 2011 list, though, let's talk about one that didn't make it, one that you actually wrote the review for a couple weeks ago, and the one that won the Oscar this year, which is The Artist. What exactly? I mean, your review was Spartan. I mean, I know that you definitely described what you wanted to describe in it, but do you care to maybe go into a little bit more depth as to why?
Sure.
It did not make your top.
Sure. When I write my reviews for the blog, I try to keep them short and simple. I don't want
to subscribe to the Chris Pagano method.
I do not do the Chris Pagano method where, you know, rambling on and everything that you liked and hate about the film is on the page. I mean, I appreciate that, Chris, but I just want to keep it short and to the point. Mm-hmm. And what I wrote on The Artist, I called it The Artless.
Yes, you did.
Simply that it's something, it's a gimmick. It's very superficial. There's not a lot of depth or story or anything new or creative about it. The characters kind of reflect this idea that art nowadays is so tied into movie and what's popular that it makes me cringe as an artist myself. The whole idea of art is you're trying to show or represent something about life, the present day, you know, the problems of the present day, and you're trying to offer a solution. You know, or if you don't even get that far, just, you know, if you can't even offer a solution, just at least expose something that's wrong with society, because it's our job as artists to expose it and try to fix it, or at least, you know, get people to encourage them to fix it.
Yeah.
This is just it's superficial, egotistical garbage. Those are strong words. Don't get me wrong. I don't think it's a terribly done movie. I think technically it's brilliant. I think, you know, it looks like the film. I think the main actor Jean Depardieu or whatever his name is.
Uh-huh.
He looks like one of those 20s guys. So in terms of, you know, trying to capture that style, it does
great job. Yeah,
does a great job, but. You know, again, that's all surface. That's superficial. That's not something that's benefiting society. And I think the big joke is everyone's saying that this is an homage to the end of the silent era and the beginning of the sound era. But actually, if you look at the director's previous work, he made a spoof on spy films. I think this is actually, the artist has been, he made it as a parody of this era. And it's not an homage. It's something to make fun of. This filmmaking style and the filmmaking era, and it's the Academy actually got it wrong, and they think they're doing something to show off how smart they are, but in reality, it's not.
So, if you think of it as a parody, do you find your opinion of it better if you're like, yeah, this is definitely a parody, or if you view it through like parody glasses, or do you still keep the same? Keep the same opinion.
I still keep the same opinion. I mean, when I think about it now as a parody, because I think that's what it was,
mm-hmm.
it's not funny. It really isn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I brought up in my review my own personal experience about, you know, making something like this as a student, and I think it would be in a good experiment as a student, but to have it as a major film that's winning all these awards and all these accolades and getting all this recognition for something that's pretty much should be a 10-minute short.
Okay.
It's kind of ridiculous, and I think it's just very representative of the culture that we live in right now, that people really like gimmicks, they really like spectacle. Mm-hmm. It's all about the hype rather than about the substance. You know, I'm working in the wine industry myself right now, and you know, I deal with wine, beer, and spirits. It's all about the bling. It's all about the image.
Yes, yes.
Rather than what's in the bottle. I think this, you know, it's a trend that you're seeing that's permeating our culture. That's for me as an artist is very disgusting. I think true artists out there need to be making films and writing things, whether it's TV, books, or movies, that are exposing this hypocrisy, that people, this idea of taste is very subjective. That's I'll agree with that, but we need to actually start being critical of what we're given. You know, film is a very powerful medium and a tool that can be used as propaganda, and I see your and it's permeating our culture so much, I think people are actually believing the propaganda, and that's scary for me. Mm-hmm. And I think as artists, true artists out there, we need to be exposing this and, you know, showing what's wrong with society and trying to fix it. And I think The Artist is just a very typical film that, you know, may not get the box office credit. The masses didn't see it. But, you know, at the other, on the flip side, it's the Academy's way of showing that they think they're smarter than everyone else.
Yeah.
But they're really not. They're just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So I dislike the film because it has a terrible message, and it's all a gimmick and nothing more, no substance to it.
Yeah, I mean it's basically just, I mean even if it is a parody, like you said, I still only watched like the first half hour. I've never really been, I mean, I was a film student, but I've never been one of those guys that have enjoyed all the silent movies and that kind of stuff. I don't know why. Maybe I just never gave them a chance. But silent movies from that era usually are not my forte. But, you know, it does end up being just a replica. And to me, it didn't seem as though it was overly exposing anything about how ridiculous those movies used to be or how ridiculous the movies used to be made. So even if it is a parody, it isn't a very good one.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I think that's... That's also the problem with it, too. So whether you look at it as it being an homage or a parody, I think it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the clues that are kind of showing me that it is a parody, A, the filmmaker's previous work, but mm-hmm. B, you know, within the film, you know, right away you see the main actor. He's on the stage for, what, 5-10 minutes, like just smiling and waving to the
smiling,
audience?
Smiling, waving, and bowing and all that kind of stuff.
And there's this sense of being over the top and all the and drawing out a lot of scenes like this. So you draw out that him like waving and smiling at the audience. This I don't know if you got to that part yet, but the scene where he's actually burning his own film, it's an over the top, over dramatized scene that goes mm-hmm. on for 10 minutes, and it's just it's trying. I think it's trying to make fun of a silent era where it is very melodramatic, and you know it's trying to show off action and trying to get very emotional, but it just doesn't work. And
well, silent movies in general are you know back then when there was only silence to be had, I think overdramatic acting probably was more. Was almost needed more just because you couldn't hear. I mean, you can't really read the inflection in someone's voice in a you know a cue card or a you know.
True, and I would just whatever. I'll just say this about silent cinema. You know, a lot of them are a lot of those films are not that good,
mm-hmm.
but the ones that stand out and the ones that are really good and are really memorable are the ones that didn't focus on these you know heavy drawn out emotions on the face. It was about the action on screen and the mm-hmm. interplay of characters within the screen and the sense of space and the realism. You know, the greatest filmmaker you can think of from that era, I think, is Charlie Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Chaplin made a medium that was very entertaining because it was funny.
Yes.
But why was it funny? Because he was using the space. He was showing this little tramp character within this world and his interaction with characters and set pieces and all this different stuff that makes it so genius. Those are the ones that are the true art forms of the silent era. And when you look at the artist, does it do anything like that? No, it doesn't. There's a lot of head coverage and kind of like they're shooting it like these people are talking with each other, but we can't hear what they're saying.
Yeah.
And that's actually not how the silent era shot. They didn't really, you know, do talking heads like that. The only reason they would do a close-up is to show the emotion of the character.
Yeah.
You know, D.W. Griffith was the one pretty much that, you know, definitely was a major part in discovering this sense of the close-up. The close-up is to, you know, pull you in and reveal something, whether it's an emotion on the face or a little trinket that the person is holding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this idea to juxtapose with the more typical shot, which was a medium shot or a long shot. So
yeah, I mean, a close-up is used to, you know, inform the viewer of something that they might not be able to see.
Correct. And then the artists, they actually use a lot of these close-ups, you know, just as they would be shooting a sitcom. First you talk, and then you talk, and then you talk, and then you talk. And
yeah.
And actually a lot of the title cards just went on and on and on and on with dialogue. And in the silent era, it was not about dialogue. It was about action.
Yeah.
And it was about emotion. So I think it gets it wrong in that sense as well.
Okay. Before we move on, do you have any comments on why there seem to be so many movies that were nominated for the Oscars that had the decade of the 1920s play like such an integral part? If you have any sort of thing on that.
Well, I kind of wrote about that in my review for my favorite films of the year. I think there's just this. I think it has to do with the times that we're living now. People don't really want to accept the negativity or to accept the bad circumstances that are happening economically,
mm-hmm.
culturally. And so if you notice, a lot of the films that are being recognized or a lot of the films that are earning the most money are fantasies that are trying to recapture the past.
Mm-hmm.
This looking back, because it's easier to deflect and to look back than it is to look at the present and deal with the present.
Well, I mean, some would argue that movies are there to distract you from the present times and you know, the harder times that they face. Clearly, that's not something that you really prescribe to. I mean,
I know
that you can find the merit in those movies, of course, if they're done well. But yeah, I'm not saying that we're in like in. We are in tough times, but it's not like you need something that's so fantastic, such a fantasy of like an era gone by, like the last decade in which really there was no great event or great events economically otherwise that kind of marred the decade, where like the 20s were kind of the last great, you know, happy decade, if you will, you know, not considering any of civil rights struggles or any of that sort
well,
of stuff.
Well, I would just say that I don't think it's wrong for a filmmaker or a film to take place in the past. I'm not saying that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think as long as what you're saying is relevant for today,
mm-hmm.
you know, to show a film that takes place in the 1800s, the idea or, you know, the true artistic idea is to displace the characters in a different era so you can look at them more objectively, but they're dealing with issues that are very relevant today, whether it be gender issues or race issues or economic issues.
Yeah.
That's one thing. What I'm seeing in these films is they're doing it because they can, or they're doing it because it's easy. There's, you know, whether it be the artist, you know, it's going back to the end of the silent era and the beginning of the sound era. What's the relevance of today?
Yeah.
How does that apply today?
Yeah.
You know, you look at Midnight in Paris. It goes, you know, it's about this character that has this nostalgia for the 1920s Paris. What relevance is that today?
Well, I would say Midnight in Paris the message of Midnight in Paris, at least, was somewhat relevant as just by saying that, you know, he has this nostalgia, but by the end he does, in fact, realize that, you know, every era is basically the same.
Or I would agree.
It's not as great as you would have thought it was. You
know? I would agree. Midnight in Paris did have a good idea, mm-hmm. but I think there are so many flaws with that film. First off, the casting. Mm-hmm. Instead of Owen Wilson and who played
McAdams.
Her? Rachel McAdams playing her fiancé. Now it should have been a Woody Allen and Diane Keaton, and it should have been made in the 70s. Because, you know, Owen Wilson doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that even knows what 1920s Paris is. he looks like he's a guy that is more interested in 80s surfer films. Okay. And I think that was a problem with the casting. Woody Allen wrote himself, so a Jewish neurotic from New York, mm-hmm. and Owen Wilson doesn't fit that, doesn't have the personality to fit that, and it's nothing against Owen Wilson. It's just, you know, film is about symbols, and, you know, Owen Wilson just doesn't occur to one as being someone that's interested in either anything intellectual or anything past, you know, further back than 1980.
Okay.
So that's wrong. Rachel McAdams, I think, was wrongly classed because in that part you need someone that needs to be lovable right away. So someone like Diane Keaton, you know, as an audience member, you are attracted to something about them. They're cute, they're lovable, they're tangible, they're real. But then over time, you as an audience member need to start to despise them because
yes.
of their beliefs, their ideology, and their materialism.
Yeah.
In
my review of Midnight in Paris, I believe I said that exact same thing where, at least to me, one of the biggest problems was, I mean, yeah, the casting was off. I don't think I mentioned that too much, but it was off for the main guys. But I think my biggest problem with the movie was just that it was completely unbelievable, or at least you didn't understand why these two had been together in the first place. Like,
correct. And again, if you had Woody Allen and Diane Keaton right away, you can understand why they're together. There's a sort of quirkiness about each of those characters that's you know, immediately attractive
mm-hmm.
to not only us, the audience, but to each other, the characters within the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can understand that and living together and being with each other and expressing their concerns and ideas and their fears, then you realize there is a schism and a split. And that's what Owen Wilson should have been. I mean, that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
Owen Wilson has this realization that this is not the girl for him. But I could have told him that at the beginning,
yeah.
because it's Rachel McAdams.
Yeah.
Just look at her. Of course she's superficial and fake.
Yeah.
But I mean so I didn't like Midnight in Paris because of the casting, but also going back to the whole point of the film, which is you're not very happy with your era. You're always looking back to the past, but you need to attack and live in the era you are now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the message comes across too much because. You know, during the whole dream sequences, dreamlike or not, him going back to the 1920s, he's introduces so many different characters. They're all, again, just images and ideas of what these people probably were like in the
1920s. Yeah, I mean, they're caricatures.
You never felt a realism of the 1920s. And so when Maureen Cotillard has this idea that she can't stand the 1920s, you know, us as audience members, what we're introduced to, Owen Wilson, we don't understand that either we don't understand it because it's so great, the 1920s, what we're being presented.
Mm-hmm.
If Woody Allen would have concentrated on, let's say, a Hemingway, just one character, and then you may be introduced to all these other characters, but if you just, you know, stick with one character and see all the troubles that they're seeing and see all, you know, the fallacies of that era,
mm-hmm.
then it would have been a little more believable and the idea would have come across, a theme.
Yeah, plus the realization scene, if you will, by Owen Wilson, where he realizes that, you know, the 20s aren't... I guess he's supposed to realize that, you know, the 20s aren't as great as he thought, and...
He realized it because it was written down in the script. It wasn't...
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't natural or organic in the film, and so... The idea of the film, I think, was good. Execution was terrible.
Okay. Speaking of going back in time, you have, well, not going back in time, but movies that take place in an earlier time. You actually do have one of these, I think, one. There might I've never seen Melancholia, and I don't know much about it. But Tree of Life definitely takes place back in the 60s, I believe. So, and that ended up making your top five list. At least parts of it did. So what did Tree of Life do that some of these other ones did not?
I think Tree of Life was not necessarily about a specific time period. I think it was about characters and a family that all of us as audience members could read into ourselves. Mm-hmm. It was an impressionistic piece, and the characters were very, in a sense, stereotypical.
Yes.
But at the same time, not a lot of character was given, so that the whole film is supposed to be a personal experience, mm-hmm. an individual experience. I think I had the same feeling when I watched this as I do 2001. It's what you bring into the film that really matters. It wasn't necessarily about plot or characters within the film or even era. And I kind of like how Malick sets up the film as spanning across time, and I think that was the importance of showing the evolution of animals and the dinosaurs, mm-hmm. because it's not necessarily about a time or a place. It's about the human experience. You know, what are we in nature? How are we compared to nature? What's our relationship to nature? As what, you know, the relationship of these animals to nature? What is our relationship between ourselves? What in a sense, what is the meaning of life?
Yes.
And so the 50s were just, I think it's set in the 50s or early 60s. It's just one of these kind of cookie cutter American images that you get. Mm-hmm. But it's very plain. And like I said, the audience is supposed to bring in their own personal experiences, their own beliefs, their own ideology, and read whatever they want to the film. So it's not necessarily about an era.
Yeah, Malick's films in general, I would say, have he wants the audience to bring in their own thoughts and really connect emotionally with it. It's a very personal experience.
Correct.
Most of his films. So.
And that's why I love this film, because the characters are so general, and again, it's what you bring into it. And I had a problem with, let's say, New World, because it was John Smith, it was Pocahontas. They're real historical characters that the audience is already bringing their preconceived notions into the film, which disrupts this impressionistic piece. I think, like, New World is beautiful, the way it's shot, and I think it's what he was trying to do in Tree of Life. The problem is he's using true historical people, that whether you're a fan of the Disney version or you're actually a student of history, mm-hmm. you're bringing in preconceived notions that disrupts that personal experience that you should be having. Whereas in Tree of Life, they're very general characters. You don't know anything about them. You can relate. In some sense, everyone's had a father. Everyone's had a mother.
Yeah.
You know, people have grown up with either friends or siblings. And so they're very general, the general family set that you are allowed as an audience member to bring in whatever you want.
Okay. Going to the other Oscar-nominated movie that is on your list, The Descendants. This is yet another movie that I have not seen. In fact, I've only seen one of the movies.
Chris, what have you seen?
The only thing on your list is Drive that I've seen. So,
I read your re-review, mm-hmm. and you know, based on your review, you were disappointed. And I was talking to Jake earlier.
Before we get into that,
okay.
Talk about Descendants, and then I'm going to ask you about Drive after that.
Okay. Okay, The Descendants, I thought was when I first viewed it, I thought it was very simple, mm-hmm. but it was very direct in what it was doing with in terms of the relationships and I liked the fact that it all came down to a decision: do we sell out or do we not sell out? Mm-hmm. And George Clooney rises to the occasion and he doesn't sell out. And so I think that's a very moral high ground in today's culture. People are always selling out, and that alone separates it from most movies out there. What I didn't like about The Descendants on my first viewing is that it was so simply shot. It wasn't very filmic. It was very cookie cutter technically.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot going for it. But when I think back on it, it wasn't about the technical aspects. It wasn't about the cinematography. It wasn't about the production. It was about the characters, the story, letting those relationships play out organically. And I appreciate it for that. So I don't think The Descendants is great, but it's relevant for today. Mm-hmm. One thing I really appreciate is that it kind of demystifies this idea of Hawaii. So anyone from the United States mainland, you know, they have this idea that Hawaii is great. It's a fantasy land. It's an escape, a place for escape. But George Clooney,
is not, yeah.
George Clooney, you know, he demystifies it right away. He says this place, people need to work, people need to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, there are lives that are going on here day in, day out, and so it kind of just it takes that all away. And doesn't make and again, it's not about spectacle. It's getting underneath and talking about real characters, real relationships.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that.
If The Descendants had been more interesting cinematographically. There you go. That's the one. Would it have? Do you think it would have been better, or do you think it would have ended up actually hurting what was going on in the movie? Because it seems like you originally were uninterested or didn't think it was that great because of its simplicity in visually. But do you think if it was more I'm not saying like more spectacled, but just more interesting visually, do you think that would have helped, or do you think it would have ended up just taking away from the more important parts of the film, the relationships and the characters and stuff?
I think looking back, it would have hurt the simplicity of the story. I think if anything that would have made it a better film is probably more action or more interaction among the characters, better plot devices and things like that. It was more about story and character and the decisions of characters. And so I think the form of a film should definitely reflect the substance, and I think the simplicity now, I can take it. I think it does what it needs to do, because it's not about the camera work, it's not about the shots.
Yeah.
And so I think if it was a little bit more glossy or glitzy, it would have actually detracted from the film.
All right. Okay. Now, the only movie I have seen, Drive. I'm going to ask you, have you seen the movie more than once?
No.
Okay. So that's basically when I re-reviewed it, I had seen it in the theater, and I believe I even mentioned in the re-review that it was much more intense in the theater, just because the images and, like, you know, the theater experience is completely different than sitting in your boxers on the couch watching a movie on your television. But my biggest problem with Drive was that, I mean, it was good. It's good because it's different. It's an action film, or it's like an action sort of suspensey action sort of thing, and it's good because it is different from, you know, the genre. It does something different with a usually fairly cookie cutter genre. But for me, the second viewing of Drive was just. It was very hard for me to get through the second movie, the second viewing, because of just the ridiculous. The pacing is off, like the crescendo, the overall story crescendo is off. It doesn't. It kind of hits its crescendo in the middle, and then the last half, the movie becomes something different almost. I mean, I don't know, I think it should be commended for what it tried to do, but ultimately I feel as though it could have been executed better to me. So what exactly did you like about Drive so much that made you put it on your top five?
I liked it because I think it's a little bit, it's a little bit smarter than your average fare up there. I think it's not trying to take itself so seriously. I think it's not necessarily trying to, be perfectly paced or have the perfect action sequence or have even the best acting. Mm-hmm. I think it is a little over the top and a little ridiculous, almost like a comic book characters. They're very cookie cutter, very stereotypical.
Mm-hmm.
But what I read into it is it pretty much is it's if the film is making fun of an audience that might like it. You know, this is not Fast and Furious, but if you look at the marketing campaign, it acts like it is an action film.
Mm-hmm.
But what really grabs me is everyone talks about the chase sequence at the beginning. I go before that. I go with the titles and the music and the shots of the city. You know, they're presenting shots of a city that's very gritty, but then you start having this 80s music and this pink text on the screen, and that juxtaposition just tells me that it's kind of making fun of like an 80s era. Mm-hmm. You know, this 80s era where things don't really match, and it's kind of goofy, and this kind of sets the tone for everything, I think.
Okay.
And everyone talks about the chasing, which is what I at the beginning, which I think is great. It gets the hook. It grabs you.
Yes.
And it takes you along. But then after that, you know, the relationships, the characters are very cookie cutter, but they're very interesting, and they're reflecting a sense of economic insecurity and questioning you know, motivation of greed. You know, I'm going to start writing a paper on this, but when you look at all the characters and how they interact and what the relationship is, it's a very employer-employee kind of a relationship. You have Ron Perlman. He's a small business owner. He has that restaurant. You have the guy from Malcolm in the Middle. He's a small business owner. He owns a car shop. You have this entrepreneur, Albert Brooks. He's a guy that, you know, he gives money to people that he thinks have good ideas. You know, back in the 80s, he made movies. He produced movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that whole comment where he produced movies. Critics called them very European. He thought they were trash.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then you have Gosling, the character. He's this employee. He's running errands for people. He's the one that's kind of filling this void. And you notice that what drives everyone is this greed for money. But what drives Ryan Gosling's character is very ambiguous. Why does he do what he does? Why does he help this girl? Is it love? Well, no, because he still helps the girl even when the
husband is
released from jail. So what drives him? You really don't know, but what you do know, it's not egotistical, it's not self-centered, he's not doing it for money, he's doing it for something else, and that kind of puts a whole monkey in the wrench, if you will, about the whole system, and it brings down the entire system. And so I'm reading into it more thematically rather than technically, and I think there's something that's going on, and again, it goes back to that 80s era, and that's where a lot of what's happening today started, you know, with deregulation of economics, with this me generation, this very self-interested sense of greed, where everyone's out for themselves and they're not paying attention to the whole. You know, it's great. I think at the beginning of the movie, Albert Brooks says, "Yeah, sure, I'll finance this guy," and he's acting, you know, in a self-centered way, but at the same time, you know, everyone's winning. He wins. The garage owner wins.
Ryan Gosling wins. Yeah.
Everyone wins. But then the moment, you know, he gets attacked or he has this idea that he might, you know, he might lose his life or whatever, he gets very animalistic, instinctual. He needs to, you know, make sure all loose ends are cut off. And so what happens in the end, he starts killing everyone, but then he ends up killing himself. And I think we're living in an era and a culture, it's reflecting a culture where everyone is so self-interested and so egotistical in the sense of greed and they're money-driven that everyone's only looking out for themselves. And
they're willing to destroy the world around them.
And we're willing to destroy the world around us, as long as they get what they want. But then in the end, they don't get what they want because they're dead too.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a little bit more – I think it's a little bit smarter than a lot of films out there and a little more reflective of what's going on. I mean, I don't – intentionally, did the filmmakers do this on purpose or not? I can't say. But this is what I got. There's so many clues. I mean, the fact that Albert Brooks, a comedian, a comic, is playing the bad guy, that itself kind of clues me that it doesn't take itself so seriously.
Okay. Well, I don't know either. For some odd reason – I guess I never looked at it in those lights, in that light, I guess. So as sort of a social commentary while also kind of not, I mean, kind of poking fun, but not really, but like, Yeah, I understand what you're saying now, and if that is intentional, then I think I would have to probably.
But again, I mean, is it intentional or not? I don't know. But that's what I get from the film. That's why I appreciate it.
Okay.
And I think it's definitely worthy of being looked at in that kind of perspective rather than just an action film that may or may not get it technically right, that the acting may or may not be on. Because honestly, I didn't think the acting was that great, but it served its purpose. It's supposed to be over the top. It's not supposed to be this great realistic film. It's supposed to be a little goofy.
Okay.
And I think it is a little goofy. I mean, you have Ron Perlman also as the other baddie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Ron Perlman doesn't really strike you as a really smart guy that knows what he's doing. And honestly, I think, you know, when it comes down to it, he might have been cast because he kind of has, I don't want to make fun of Ron Perlman, but he's not the most human-looking person.
No.
He definitely reminds you of our ancestors.
He's definitely a more brutish Viking type person. Yeah.
Exactly, and I think, you know, that character is actually what he plays. He's very instinctual. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really think things through, and he acts on instinct. Whereas, you know, the Albert Brooks character is a little bit more thoughtful, and he's the Himmin and Hummin originally, but then in the end he just makes the choice because it's the most logical.
Okay.
Of destroying everyone around him. So it's kind of interesting what's going on. Then you have, I keep forgetting his name, the Malcolm in the Middle
Bryan
dad?
Bryan
Cranston.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's that coward. He does things in a cowardly way. He gets what he wants in a cowardly way. So he's not necessarily the top dog. He's not necessarily the best thinker. He acts on emotion. He's that dog with the tail between his legs that will
he's the guy that will take a knee before a king or queen to get this point is going nowhere. I can't even remember where I was
going with this.
But yeah, he's more of a supplicant sort of guy. Getting what he wants by, you know, basically a yes man almost kind of thing.
Yes, yes. He's a yes man.
Wow.
Yep.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, like, you know, that's why I like Drive. And
okay.
I, like I said, I read your re-review, and I understood your points, but I don't think you were looking at least from my perspective, I don't think you were looking at the film in the right way or the way it could be looked at.
Yeah, I had definitely never considered it the way that you just described it. So,
and I may be wrong. I mean, but you know,
no, I mean that makes a lot of sense. Now that you've opened my eyes, if you will, to that particular reading or viewing of the movie. So, okay. Well, we've got two other ones here, two of which I have not seen, of course.
What's new?
Yeah, clearly I've come into this podcast doing my research. do you want to briefly discuss either of those? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, yeah, we got to round out the five. So let's see. I had Descendants at five, Drive at four. We kind of skipped around a little bit. Tree of Life at three.
Yes.
So next is I'll talk about A Separation a little bit.
Okay.
Separation is an Iranian film.
Yeah, this is kind of, from what I've read about it at least, this seems very much so what you were talking about earlier when discussing the artist, where clearly it does happen in present day, but it also makes sure to push present day issues.
I think I can honestly say this is not a masterpiece. This is not a great film. I know that this film has been on number one on a lot of lists or up there. I guess no different from mine, but I would say, you know, say this with caution that it's, again, it's not a masterpiece. It's not a great film. It's a movie that has character, has plot, has story. It's interesting, cinematically.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's what films need to be. All films need to be. At least this is the bar that you need to be shooting for every time you make a film.
Okay.
And I think the problem is, and you see with a lot of critics nowadays, films have gotten so bad. Films are awful nowadays that the bar has been lowered so much that a film that does its job is now being recognized as being great.
Yeah.
And I think that's wrong. You know, what I think back last, is it last year, the King's Speech won.
Yes, last year.
And the King's Speech, honestly, it's a movie that has a plot goes from A to B. There's character development. You got little characters that have quirks. But honestly, is it a great film? No.
I mean, it's a solid. It's not great.
It's a solid movie.
You can't really poke that many holes into.
No, it's a solid movie, and that's what movies should be. Solid. That's if you're spending all this money on films, you're getting all this great talent involved. This is what a movie should be.
Okay.
And to say that it's a best picture, or to say a Separation is a masterpiece, I think that's wrong. I think it's a very good film, and I think it's one of the better out there. A, it's done well, but B, it's tackling issues that are important today. But I do want to emphasize that it is not a great film, and it's not going to be, blowing your socks off. So if you haven't seen it, I don't want to overhype it like a lot of critics are doing. It is what it is, and it does it well.
Well, I mean, I know with The Separation, a lot of the buzz has been about, because it's coming from Iran and because it has this sort of storyline that I guess is not clearly culturally as prevalent perhaps in the Middle East. I feel like that's another reason why so many people are kind of giving it so much buzz, because of where it's from and what it's saying about that particular area, I suppose.
And I think this is just also shows the disconnect the Americans have from other regions of the world. Iran, everyone's talking, in the news lately, everyone's talking about sanctions, everyone's talking about bombing, and this whole idea of the United States and Israel bombing Iran. You got to remember, Iran is a very complex nation. You have the Ayatollah in charge, you have the president, but you have this young base of people that's the majority of the population that is upset with the regime. They're upset with how things are being done over there. And you got to realize there's such a weird dynamic going on over there that Americans, just to generalize and say, oh, it's a patriarchal religious society, and that's it. That's wrong.
I think
if we understood that, if we did a little more research, if we took a little bit more time to understand other cultures, it wouldn't be such a big surprise that a film like this would be made. Mm-hmm. And it just upsets me that everyone feels they know the answer to everything, but they don't even understand what the issues are to begin with, and that's disturbing. Mm-hmm. Again, it's this what you're being fed on the news. Oh, Iran is bad.
Yeah.
Iran is bad. Oh, Iran is bad. We need to bomb them. But that is so simplistic in our thinking and so superficial that, again, whether it's movies or books, the wine business or news, something is seriously wrong.
Yes.
And I don't know, people need to just wake up or something. And again, I'm not saying I'm right or I'm wrong or whatever. I'm just saying that you need to at least open your mind a little bit and kind of research things and look at things and try to understand things and better yourself, not just accept what you're being told.
Well, I mean, I think this might be a topic of a discussion for a different time, but I think in America especially, since politically we have been and still are for the most part a two-party system sort of thing, it kind of gives off the whole black and white thing where, you're either black or you're white, and that's kind of, that clearly is hurting how we understand things anywhere in the world, let alone, in Iran or the Middle East, where, clearly they just want to say it's good or bad and not actually go into what is so bad or what is so good and how the people over there are acting or anything. So I think that sort of hurts everything. But
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's good that we're not going to go in politics, because I have a lot to say about that.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
We've got
an election coming up, maybe we'll tease a podcast in about 6-7 months, something like that, but today we'll leave that on the back burner. One last movie, your top movie, Melancholia. Give it to us. Give me what's good about this movie.
Melancholia, I said it was my number one because I think it's just the most original, most creative film that I saw last year. it's doing something that's not cliched. It's exploring ideas that are relevant and interesting to today. It's just something about it is very memorable and very attractive that I appreciate. And it, like I said, it's not caught up in a genre. It's not caught up in a particular style. It's actually really, really good. And you know, the whole idea, if you know anything about it, people have been talking about this is Lars von Trier's take on the disaster movie. You know, the end of the world. There's a planet called Melancholia that's coming on a colliding path with Earth, and they're going to destroy the world. And that to me just tells me that the studios and the industry didn't know how to market this film. Uh-huh. And that tells me also why I didn't get nominated, because the Academy, when it comes down to it, is trying to make money for these movies. It's trying to show off these movies. It's trying to help continue the industry, because money is very important with film. And that's, you know, of all the art mediums out there, film is the one that has most to do with money.
Money, yeah.
You need money to make a movie. And so the Academy's job is to make sure that, well, the industry is still making movies. And so when it comes down to Melancholia, and how do you market this film? It's very you can't market it, because what is it trying to say? It's not really a disaster movie. What I take away from is it's this idea that the end of the world is just an allegory for the upper class and their issues and their problems. So it all sets up. It's a two-part film. The first part, it's Kirsten Dunst's character, and the second part, it's from the perspective of her sister. Mm-hmm. And the first part, there's nothing. Melancholy is not even mentioned. All it is about Kirsten Dunst getting married.
Okay.
And her sister and her sister's husband, Kiefer Sutherland, have set up this elaborate, expensive wedding.
Yeah. Like a fairy tale wedding almost.
A fairy tale wedding. And Kirsten Dunst is doing everything in her power to just make sure it doesn't go right for her sister. Mm-hmm. You know, is Kirsten Dunst doing this intentionally or not? Who knows? She's very free-thinking, radical kind of person that just goes with the flow and doesn't really have a worry in the world. Mm-hmm. The sister is going out of her mind because all these little things are going wrong. We need to make sure that, you know, they had a thing at the beginning, count the number of M&Ms or beans or whatever in the jar.
Uh-huh.
And she gets mad when no one, you know, wants to guess. Or, you know, all these little things, it's like the end of the world to her sister. And I think that's the whole point. You know, you have the perspective of Kirsten Dunst. You know, nothing really matters. It's in a sense very nihilistic, but also in a sense, you know, it's just live your life and be free and do whatever.
Sort of like a don't sweat the small stuff sort of thing.
Correct. And then the second half is her sister, and it's just like the planet is just a stand-in for how she's feeling. I think during this wedding, like it's the end of the world is happening because all my friends are. You know,
it's not going perfectly right.
It's not going perfectly right, and I'm so embarrassed. And I think that, you know, it's just a very smart and funny film. A lot of people are going into it thinking it's very serious, and, you know, the stylistically, the music's very somber and everything. But I think, you know, it's actually trying to be a funny and silly, and you got to take it with a grain of salt. Like, because if you just think of, you know, the end of the world's coming and her sister's trying to get married, you know, that just seems like a funny situation to begin with, very goofy.
Yeah.
And that's what I think Lars von Trier's point might be, is it is all funny and silly. And the fact that it's set into this hideaway, this pretty much this fairyland, fairy tale castle, an upper class castle, mm-hmm. and these rich people are so, you know, exclusive and excluded from the rest of society. It's just showing, again, back to reflecting today's economic hardships and situation, the upper class really, I think, has a disconnect with the majority of people.
Oh, well, they've always had, though.
And I think vice versa. You know, there's this a startling misconception of the issues of the day. And I remember during the 90s, you know, growing up, Wall Street was good, things seemed booming, but the actual economy, people's day-to-day lives, people were still struggling, even in the 90s. And it just all came to a head the last decade because then the people on Wall Street started losing money too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there really is a disconnect between the top 1% and the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this film kind of points to that. And I think it does it in an original way that I really liked it.
All right. Okay. I have not seen that, but I think you might have just sold me on going to go see that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I think I saw some trailers and I saw, you know, some of the pre-buzz, and it just didn't seem like a movie at all that I would be interested in. So clearly they didn't market that correctly.
And once you watch it, you're going to say, well, yeah, how would you market that?
Mm-hmm.
You really can't. And, you know, Lars von Trier doesn't have the star power as a director, I think, in this country. And Kirsten Dunst, even her, she doesn't really have a star power to attract an audience.
I mean, especially not lately as well.
So you can't market it in terms of star. You can't market it in terms of genre because it's not really a genre picture. You can't market it on action because there really is no action.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very tough film to market, and it showed. It didn't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make any money, and we're not going to nominate it. And we don't care about it. So that's just the Academy's way of just showing that, you know, their awards are as meaningful as, you know, those things they give away at high school. You know, they're going to be most likely to succeed.
Yeah, the yearbook superlatives.
Yes. So, you know, it's the Academy is, you know, they are what they are, and people get so caught up in them and on these awards, and it's just, when have the Academy's really got it right? Never.
Yeah.
And when are they ever going to get it right? Never. Again, because they're it's a political process, It's a, you know, the actors are the biggest voting block. So if it's an actor's film, it more likely is going to succeed in the award season. You have Martin Scorsese didn't get an award forever for all his greatest films, and so, you know, he pretty much got an honorary award for a film that was, you know, good but not one of his greatest. Same thing with Meryl Streep this year. I haven't seen Iron Lady. I probably will never see it.
Yeah.
But it just seems like one of those awards that, well, she's been nominated so many times, so let's give it to her this time.
Well, I mean, she's gotten it before, though.
And that's the thing. She's gotten it before, but maybe she should get another one.
Yeah.
You know, all these politics are playing into it. You know, this fake sense of self-righteousness, that's why the artist won. You know, it's, so many things are involved in the Academy. They're not really showing off the best picture.
Not only that about the politicalness and you know, what they decide, but it's also, I mean, saying what's good and bad is just so subjective that...
True.
Yeah, you know, just because, I mean, people have a craving for there to be, you know, to be able to look at something and be like, oh, that is the best. And in arts especially, clearly, that's almost impossible.
Right. I mean, and the thing is, lists are very tricky. You know, I put in my review, they're fun.
Mm-hmm.
They're fun to debate. I think what's important and what's the problem with our culture is we say things that are the best. We say things that are the best or the worst, but we don't explain why. We're not going into anything really deep about these movies. We're not talking about them. We just focus on the gimmicks,
mm-hmm.
whether it's the artist because it's you know, a silent film, or you know, The Help because it's a fun book to read, or what's another?
People in the South.
Yeah. I mean, they're so superficial, these little things, and it's really sad. That's why things are good, and that's very disappointing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that's probably gonna do it for this time. We've been talking for an hour, I think, around about there. So I might have to cut it off here.
No, but no problem. I know you want to stop. You want to stop hearing me talk. That's okay.
I mean, you know, one hour of hate with Will is just is enough for any man for a couple of weeks.
well,
hope,
I'm not.
Yeah.
I was gonna say I don't hate. I love.
Yeah.
I love all.
Sure. No. I mean, we are glad to have you, your opinion on everything, especially since it is an incredibly informed and usually intelligent opinion. So that definitely helps things. But hopefully we can make this a more normal podcast. I don't know. We're discussing things. There are discussions in the midst on how to make a more normal movie podcast. So I'm sure we'll be hearing more. Over the coming weeks. So.
Oh, I definitely love it. I love talking film. I love expressing ideas. I love hearing other people's ideas. I mean, I know this, you know, you're trying to get what I thought of this podcast, but I want to hear more of what you think too. And, you know, what Jake and Joe think as well, because it's so interesting to hear people's ideas, to listen and to either agree or disagree and then tell why you agree or disagree. I think that's what we need to do here. And that's what I think people should be doing out there in the real world. But, you know, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that the collection of the movie staff, or whatever you want to call it, since no one's getting paid, the movie people on the website, I think we've got a nice collection where we bring in... We all have different things that I think we watch a movie for. I'm much more kind of story structure-based and that sort of side. And I just think that we've got a nice collection of desires of what we do when we go to the movies. So I think it'll end up working out in our favor, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, hopefully we can bring together some more movie podcasts in the near future. You can always check out the website at in-the-bag2gs.com. Hopefully we will also be able to come at you with some more articles weekly from our different contributors. But, yeah, just check us out, and we'll talk to you guys later.